Hello and welcome to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle Radio, the show all about inspiring people, innovative companies and fresh ideas in global business. Today's programme is all about going the extra mile when it comes to retail and hospitality. We'll catch up with the founder of a retail group that's redefining the shopping experience by attracting global luxury consumers through a blend of experiences, fashion and entertainment.
Bicester Collection exists today to deliver unreasonable hospitality to guests who come to visit us. And that's functionally about the memory making, that journey of finding ways to advance physical experience, which is not moving particularly fast at all when compared to shifts in technology.
This is The Entrepreneurs with me, Tom Edwards. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs. Friend of the show, Scott Malkin, is the founder and chairman of Value Retail, the creator and operator of the Bicester Collection, a family of 11 luxury shopping tourism destinations spread across Europe and China, with more than 1,300 boutiques representing the world's leading fashion and lifestyle brands. Last year, the villages welcomed more than 45 million guests, and soon the portfolio will welcome a 12th edition. In the coming months, Value Retail is set to unveil its ambitious new village at Belmont Park in New York, marking the company's debut in North America. Scott stopped by Monocle HQ in Zurich to catch up with Monocle's chairman and editorial director, Tyler Brulé, and to talk about the new campus, the limitations of online retail, and the importance of offline experiences with unrivaled hospitality. Tyler began by asking Scott to reflect on society's paradoxical relationship with tech, given its omnipresence and the potential devaluation of brands due to online sales.
Scott, great having you back in Zurich. I wanted to maybe just start at a top level view. There's this gravitational pull, I think, in society. And so we can look at sort of the policymakers, but I'm wondering if there is, this sense of, does anyone like tech right now?
Society, generally speaking, at all levels, is obsessively connected to tech. And they like it because they're using it relentlessly. At another level, it's absolutely clear, and you, in a recent piece in Monocle, your journalist actually made this point, tech commoditizes, diminishes, and dilutes as it standardizes and embraces efficiency. And from a brand perspective, a fashion brand, a luxury brand, every single sale that that brand makes online, no longer perhaps through the far fetches and the matches of the world, but on its own direct site, diminishes and devalues the brand. So the physical alternative has to be the flagship definition, the emotional connection that defends and builds the brand equity, let alone acquires new customers for the brand. But not a single brand, I suspect, will take the view that they will not sell online. They might sell selectively. They might try to show some sorts of restraint to define their version of exclusivity. But whether it's TikTok or it's online sales for the top brands in the world, tech's here and deeply embedded, and we at some level are embracing it, but miserable with it. One of the realities is that the impacts are abrupt and often conclusive. So one day you're a prestige brand, and the next day, maybe because something someone did in your organization who's very remote from being a decision maker, maybe just a mechanical role, does something that can throw your brand into chaos. The organization that's good at perpetuating sales of a product is not necessarily the one that's good at responding on a dime to deal with an existential threat. So tech requires that skill set. And yet big organizations, we see many examples in government, in establishment institutions today, where the agility and the resilience to deal with those threats is rejected by those same institutions.
That notion of the abrupt is a fascinating one when we think about tech, because if we could rewind around this table over the last 36 months, it's fascinating the conversations that we've had with other leaders who talked about the power of the metaverse, who told us about the importance of Clubhouse, no one talks about the metaverse anymore. Does anyone even remember what Clubhouse is? And then, and we had many conversations with people from the art world who talked about the power of NFTs. Who's talking about those now? Maybe AI is different. Maybe it's not. But, and I guess the point I'm getting at is, are we so unilateral? And when it comes to the next big thing, the next big disruptor, that we become all consumed by it. I think this is the point. It feels like every single conference that you go to, someone has to talk about AI at the moment. But there are also other critical things I think we probably need to be talking about in the world, which aren't even about problem solving. These could be great innovations, great thinkers, great currents that are occurring. And yet sort of AI tends to sort of suck all of the air out of the room at the moment.
My favorite definition of leadership is asking the right questions. And if one looks at those conferences, the topic AI is probably inescapable and probably logical. But the conversation about AI is highly formulaic and frankly uninteresting. It's largely backward looking. The more developed, more intentional conversation isn't being promoted. So I think we're going to end up with a polarized world. There's going to be the mainstream, mostly backwards looking, mostly ill-prepared to deal with change, and fundamentally self-funding because it's establishment by nature. And then there are going to be the disruptors who like throwing bombs from the outside, and then they're going to be what I would call the participants who can understand it, build on what they learn or hear from the disruptors, lead in a disrupted environment. And the reality is that our institutions, often very significant and positive institutions, are fundamentally led by individuals who have perfect resumes, are highly capable and intelligent, hardworking, and completely unoriginal.
No fun often as well.
They've been promoted for being spectacularly effective conformists. And so not a lot of variety, not a lot of debate, not a lot of energy in the room. It's not Studio 54 at these corporate board meetings. It's some form of a futuristic monotone.
I want to walk the street with you in a moment. It could be not just getting to lunch, but whether it's the streets of Zurich, whether we're in New York, whether we're in Hong Kong. But before that, you touched on some of the main players, of course, in the digital retail space, the Farfetches, the Net-a-Porters. What's your take on what's happened? Because again, let's rewind a decade ago and the power that these businesses, well, they had and they had as brands, but we're now talking about tarnished brands, shamed brands in some ways. Is this a blip people have to somehow figure things out? Or when we're talking about either the very rare, exclusive, outstanding quality, the famous and the luxurious, is there space for that? Because we're seeing it doesn't seem to be working.
I think online multi-brand retail has always been commercially doomed. Serves a function. The brands often would find value in it. But the reason that its prospects were defined in a limiting way is that the entire space is built around the standards set by global significant organizations like Amazon or Temu. And they're not designed to make money. They're designed to gather data that allows them to make money in other ways. They're designed to perpetuate a broader platform. But I'm not an optimist on that front, and there has been no success in delivering true luxury experience as one could find in the physical realm online. I'm not optimistic that that is going to come. And if one looks at all these educational institutions that during COVID became long-distance teaching models, they've all gone back to physical with an emphasis. Why? Because actually, the students might like staying at home and lying in bed and watching a screen, but they wouldn't choose it over being with other people. And actually the vitality and the energy and the melting pot of life. Back to Studio 54. So I think the tech platforms are fantastic for testing, gathering data, in some ways looking backwards very efficiently, but they don't tell us anything about what's coming. So these are all devices to address what I think is a permanent condition, which is the enormous reliance upon tech as a tool, as opposed to tech as a purpose. And the distinction is whenever it becomes a purpose, it benefits the companies commercially who control the tech, who own the copyrights, the patents, but it doesn't help society and it doesn't help us as individuals.
Let's venture out onto the street. I'm keen to get your view, Scott, on the evolution of cities, walking three or four blocks, meandering down alleys and lanes to go and find that unique product, that unique object that you want to get your hands on. And of course, you know, the world is not, yes, Mr. Friedman tells us the world's flat, but we also don't see that there's been a completely flat recovery. We've seen some city centers bounce back because maybe they were ever thus. They were always vibrant. We've also seen new neighborhoods emerging. We've, of course, seen new patterns of commuting and what the 5-day, 7-day work week looks like. So maybe let's just start, you know, city center in the suburbs, what you see happening there. But I think also then what it means for you and what you're doing with the villages as well.
Thanks. We're actually completely committed to driving experience, raising the bar every day on the quality of physical experience and the purpose of physical experience, which is not to sell product, but to create memories. One can do them both in partnership. And we're trying to lock in on the convergence of hospitality, music. Pater said all art constantly aspires to the condition of music. The five senses, right? That's the one that captures the five senses the best. Fashion, which is fundamentally built around innovation. Fashion is innovation. By definition, it's constant reinvention. Sport, which is one of the places where people will go to be together. Look at the recent Super Bowl in Las Vegas. People went to Las Vegas to be in Las Vegas and not go to the Super Bowl, just to be part of the energy, part of the experience. And in the end, I would say technology serving that convergence. So firstly, the suburbs are and have always been bereft of critical mass and soul and energy. They can't be made. One can create a gated community and build a convening logic and create energy in a spot. It could also be in a field in the middle of nowhere. It could also be in an urban location. So that's a general truth. The suburbs don't aid that or hinder it. It's whether the right group is curated and brought together. But generally speaking, there's a reason they made films like The Stepford Wives, and it's the suburbs. Cities have great strengths and great challenges. The point about cities that makes them constantly relevant, not every city at every moment, is young people and new ideas, new trends, new fashions. That's the environment where these things can happen. And the reason that some cities are healthier and more empowering and powerful today than others is all about why young people would go and why people who are what I would call influencers, intellectually, socially, financially, are drawn to them. And you look at a city like Boston, New York, London, they're all masters of negativity. Leave. We don't like you. You know, the governor of New Jersey saying, if you don't want to pay ridiculously high taxes, you should leave. This isn't a state meant for you. It's all about criticism and punishment. So where are their celebrations? And by the way, those cities aren't dead, but they're being diminished drip by drip. And where does one find exuberance? Where does one find energy? The more that government intrudes, there's less found. The more that crime intrudes or crime exists, that pushes people who are agile and have choices away. And crime is across the board, if you define it broadly. It's failure of government to deal with social issues successfully or effectively.
I want to fast forward a few months from now. It's going to be, well, I'm sure it's a busy day for you every day, but it's going to be a very busy summer. But I think for the purposes of our audience, I want to get out to Belmont Park. Set the stage for us. What is happening there? Give us, if you can, lift a bit of the curtain. I'm curious to know what are you bringing? What is this new beachhead going to look like on Long Island?
So Belmont Park sits right on the Long Island, New York City border, and it's 10, 12 minutes, if it's not rush hour, to JFK, so incredibly central and convenient. It benefits from the first new train station on the Long Island Railroad in 50 years. The Long Island Railroad for the first time in history, now runs to Grand Central and Penn Station. And they built an express train track over 20 years. So suddenly you have accessibility, you have convenience, and you have a declining environment in metropolitan New York that's been pushing people out to New Jersey, Connecticut, and Long Island since COVID. So this is a pivot, a hub point on the transportation patterns for a huge domestic population mass and for the luxury traveling consumer, which is our raison d'etre, the audience we serve. Belmont Park itself was named after August Belmont, a financier who built the Belmont Park Racecourse, where the Belmont Stakes, the third race in the Triple Crown, is held every year. Famous distance race in the sport of kings, where the Breeders' Cup is held, and 430 acres that have actually not been touched for over 100 years. On the surface parking lots for Belmont Park Racecourse, which are occupied historically one day a year, 2 days a year for these big races, we have built the first third generation sports and music arena in the world. The racing authorities are building a new hub for racing, tearing everything up. And the track and the grandstand are designed to compete with Maidan and the other great racing hubs around the world. And then we are building the first of our Bicester Collection villages in the U.S. on the property adjoining the arena and the race course. Our last retail project in the U.S. was Tureo Drive, which is a full-price street, open-air pedestrian street in Beverly Hills, and which led to a lot of the thinking we've employed since then. The Bicester Collection today has the same principles of open-air pedestrianization, accessible architecture. We joke that the physical design of Belmont Park Village will run from Soho to Sag Harbor. You could say Montauk to Manhattan, but it's there are parts that look New York City 1930s industrial, and there are parts that look Long Island, great estates and beachfront of the same era. So like the arena, which is a McKim, Mead & White principle of design, we're embracing the traditional, but in a modern way. They're not referential to tradition. They're authentic architectural forms, but consolidated into an environment that I believe already is beginning to be recognized as a global hub. The proximity to JFK and LaGuardia, the relevance of New York, and 430 acres of $3 billion of investment, the best in class for racing, sports and music, and fashion, that starts to be noticeable. Bicester Collection exists today for two primary purposes. Number one, to deliver on reasonable hospitality to guests who come to visit us. And that's functionally about the memory making. We serve the brands serve the guest, but we're deep into that journey of finding ways to advance physical experience, which is not moving particularly fast at all when compared to shifts in technology. And secondly, we exist to acquire new full-price customers, whether that is the fashion brands acquiring affordably new full-price customers, or other parts of the commercial infrastructure that are desperate to touch that targeted long-haul consumer, traveling luxury consumer. Today, we're very primitive in how we do that, but actually, that audience is extremely difficult to attract and serve and embrace. And whether it's in an arena, you know exactly who's sitting where, and you know something about them because you know what they're paying and why they bought what they're buying, or it's shopping where you have it through every brand and their CRM and their ability to figure out how many new customers they're getting. In our villages now, although the product is authentic surplus, which is not the model in the U.S., and the model in the U.S. is MFO or made for outlet, which is secondary lines presented in an obscured way with authentic, we are obsessively and regulatorily and legally linked only to authentic surplus, but now in all our villages, a small percentage, up to 15% of the area in a unit, in a boutique, we encourage it to be used for presenting the current full price bestsellers sold at full price. And when you get on your plane at JFK or at Heathrow or at Charles de Gaulle, going back to another part of the world with an item you bought for full price and you're in love with that purchase, you are now a full price customer belonging to that brand, not just in terms of the database, but in terms of being a brand advocate, a brand ambassador. And the path we've been working on, we started this during COVID as one of a series of initiatives to project ourselves forcefully out of COVID with a vision, with a North Star. The North Star, simplistically put, is unreasonable hospitality, which is a perfect term because nobody can tell you what it means. It's borrowed from Will Goddard's book, and he's a friend, he works with us, and we have the blessing from Will to use the term, but everyone knows what hospitality is, and they'll give you lectures about how it works, how the industry works, what a great hotel experience is, which, by the way, by definition is probably untrue because they're all looking for the simple formula, the silver bullet. But unreasonable hospitality is all about what comes next. We know that it's impossible physically to see around corners, but we also know that people spend their lives trying to read and anticipate what's coming next. Every issue of Monocle talks about what's true and where it's going, where it's leading. And that's what our focus is. So you walk down this street that would feel very much like our villages in Shanghai or Madrid, but you are, and it doesn't open with a big reveal and a big jump, because actually nobody in the U.S. does this in the way we are forced to do it. And in the U.S., the great repository for brand discovery, brand introduction, they were the merchant kings, the merchant princes, Ira Niemark, Marvin Traub, Bert Tansky. Those people don't exist anymore. What department store or grand magasin presence that remains is run by financial people and real estate people. And the brands have, for some time now, really since the global financial crisis, been developing their own points of distribution, their own flagship stores and boutiques. But those are, in a sense, siloed and isolated. And even a great shopping street, are you going to walk in when there's somebody at the door looking intimidating and you don't know the brand, and maybe there's a queue anyway? So we're the emotionally accessible embrace of fashion. That's our goal. And the unreasonable hospitality part goes right to working with Ecole Hospitalière de Lausanne, the great hotel school, creating training for those who work in the Bicester collection, in the boutiques that are controlled by the brands, in the arena. We have a couple of hotels on the beach in California, which we run as laboratories for human experience. The entire exercise is how to make them not feel like normal hotels and how to make the guest feel there's something different. And what's exciting for me about any of these locations, any of these venues, is I can think of 100 things we could do better. Bicester Village is 30 years old. I give us a 6 out of 10, and it generates the highest sales densities per square foot in the world. And it has every great brand with the exception of one or two there. And yet we have a lot of ground we can and should cover. So the Bicester Collection vision is to welcome you in September at Belmont Park Village, have you walk around with us, look around and say, I can guess where this is headed. I have a sense of what's around the corner. I want to come back. We want to be one of the great shopping destinations in the world. And we want Belmont Park at 430 acres of true parkland in the middle of a dense urban New York to be one of the places people know around the world for different reasons, horse racing, sports and music, fashion. But in the end, we are confident that it should and will become a landmark location. Back to this notion of diversity, critical mass, and the energy of invention that are very hard to create in cities today, because cities are typically mature, have limited flexibility, and where they do create it, it's Williamsburg and Brooklyn. It's being pushed out of the core. It used to be Soho, and now it's it's meatpacking, but it's not the Upper East Side, which is legitimate and relevant on its own, but it's not where the innovation hubs blossom.
Finally, just before we go, and I'm also just conscious of time because we should be at our table 2 minutes ago. Scott, just break this down in numbers, because already you've been maybe giving a little bit of a cue in terms of saying that you're going to, whether you're at Charles de Gaulle, whether you're getting back on your plane at JFK, there is this sort of sense of the foreign visitor, inbound, outbound. But just in numbers, how many hospitality F&B units are we going to see at launch? How many traditional retailers? And where are people coming from? Is it 60% local, 40% overseas? Is it 40% local, 30% elsewhere in the U.S., 30% long haul? How do the numbers break down for Belmont Park?
So the key is the traveling luxury consumer. And she could live across the street or she could live halfway around the world. So her core attribute is she has a passport and is happy to travel. She's happy to migrate towards experience. So the transcendentalist spoke about how the journey is more relevant than the destination. She's our target. In the early moments of any new project of ours, this will be our 12th in the Bicester collection on the retail side. We open in stages, actually in physical phases. We have a soft opening like restaurants. We don't open with a big grand or like a Broadway show. We go on the road first, physically, as it were. We're euphemistically on the road. Belmont Park Village, when fully open, which will take about 3 years, will open in phases. We'll have 165 boutiques. It will have about 10 food and beverage points. We never work with volume fast food. We never work with food courts. It's all about an experiential quality where someone says, I can and will come back maybe once a year, maybe in another outpost of the Bicester collection somewhere else in the world, but I'll plan to spend the day. I'll plan to shop seriously and take home gifts, purchases, memory that represent memories. And our target guest in our villages around the world today spends 6 or 8 hours and regularly spends $100,000, pounds, euros in one visit. Now, we have Black Book concierge services. We have clienteling. We have private client shopping. And these are clearly people buying high price points, the bulk of which are because it's authentic surplus a year behind at reduced pricing. But I was at lunch earlier this week with a woman who can shop anywhere she wants. And she's telling everyone at the table about why she loves Bicester Village. This was in London where we were having lunch. And her description, it's fantastic because she's saying, this is a place of relevance to me because it makes me happy. And because I'm happy, the brands I embrace when I'm there, I feel good about. And the purchases I make when I'm there inspire me. And I will go back again, maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year, and I will spend another full day. The first time she went on her own, the next time she went with her daughter and her daughter-in-law, maybe the next time she's going to go with a friend or two. But she spent at those levels. And that is the outlier, the customer whom we aim to serve everywhere. In our mature villages in the West, we're easily 50% not from the domestic catchment. China, we have projects in Suzhou and Shanghai, and there it's a reopening. All places, it's a reopening from COVID, but there it's domestic internal travel. There's relatively little external inbound travel, which was always the vision. New York, I think, will, my guess is, will look a lot like our experiences in London and Paris and be truly a hub location with a minimum of 50% international or distance traveler. JFK is down the road. That's international. But LaGuardia is also just down the road. And that's a more domestic-based, again, visitor to the region, not even necessarily visitor to Manhattan, visiting family, friends, commercial reasons to be in what is one of the great metropolitan hubs of the world.
That was Scott Malkin, the founder and chairman of Value Retail, in conversation with Monocle's Tyler Brûlé. And you can learn more about the brand, of which Scott is the steward, by heading to valueretail.com. And that's all for this episode of The Entrepreneurs. We'll be back at the same time next week. The programme was produced by Laura Kramer, with mixing and editing by Tamsin Howard. You can listen again and find out more about the show at monocle.com, or you can follow us and catch up with the archive via your preferred podcast platform. If you'd like to contact the team, write to Laura on lrk@monocle.com. I'm Tom Edwards. Goodbye, and thanks for listening to The Entrepreneurs.